to another episode of A to Z here on Iron English Radio, and farewell for now. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of A to Z. And for more information, please also visit our website at www.iranradio.ir.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality, culture, Eastern tales, roundtable discussions, politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
From the vibrant city of Tehran, welcome to a brand new day on Iran Radio. I'm so glad you've joined us. Ahead lies a schedule full of compelling discussions, stirring stories and perspectives that challenge and uplift. First, we bring you Israel Watch. After this program, we have another segment of radio productions. Following this, we will shed light with the lantern. For now, please stay tuned for Israel Watch.
Thank you for joining us. The Hebrew media focused in its analysis and expert commentary on the ongoing reach ceasefire agreement in the Gaza Strip and the exchange of captives, as well as on the repercussions of the Yemeni support front for Gaza and the attacks that targeted ships heading to the occupation's ports. Also on the agenda was the normalization talks between Tel Aviv and the Golani government. These topics will be the focus of this episode, discussing it with Dr. Mohammed Suaidan, academic and writer in international affairs, joining us here in the studio. Hello and welcome, Dr. Mohammed. The special operation that targeted Zionist soldiers in the Gaza Strip, in which one of them was nearly captured by the resistance fighters after being wounded, was a major topic in Hebrew media. Commentators were struck with amazement and fear, especially since the footage released by Al-Qassam of the operation contradicted the occupation army's claims that the soldier had faced the fighters, when in fact he was fleeing the scene after being wounded. Well, Dr. Mohammed, how do you explain this intensified operations against the Israeli soldiers, occupation forces, after 21 months?
Well, to be honest, here there are two sides, the tactical one and the strategic one. On the tactical level, I think it's a major failure for the Israeli army. The Israeli army isn't just a small group of people fighting. It's one of the best armies in the world. It has been inside of Gaza for nearly 2 years, and till now, it hasn't been able to eliminate the threat inside Gaza. More than that, the areas where these operations are happening are far 2 to 3 kilometers to the Israeli settlements, so they are too near. The Israeli army have never left, even during the ceasefire, never left part of these places. Still, they are being hit by the Palestinians. Okay. So today, on the tactical level, it's a huge failure. But the most important thing is on the strategic level. For this operation to continue, this means that till now, after 21 months, Israel didn't achieve any strategic goal in the region, regardless of how much killing there is, how much damage there is. But let's see what are the strategic goals. In Gaza, there is still a very strong resistance that is making the Israeli pay a huge cost, and it still can veto a ceasefire agreement that doesn't maintain
its interests. You spoke about clear strategy also. Clear strategy. What is it? Because yesterday's episode, our own guest actually highlighted and analyzed, he said that, when asked a similar question, he said that the resistance fighters, Palestinian resistance, developed techniques after 21 months that allowed them to retrieve their own power and go back to the battlefield stronger than ever.
This is what the Americans have been saying to the Israelis since day one. Since they told them that This is an insurgent, they call it an insurgent
group. They
learned
from their mistakes.
They learned from their mistakes in Afghanistan and Iraq and in different places. Resistance groups learn throughout war. That's why it's always, it's written in...
During the war.
Yes, it's written in American academia that when you go and fight resistance groups, you shouldn't go for a long time, because as the war moves more with time, you will have less leverage as a country or state or Israeli entity, and the resistance will be able to tolerate, to learn more from the battlefield, and it will make you inflict more costs. And this is what we are seeing today.
It can recruit more also.
It can recruit more. It can learn Israeli tactics, how to avoid them, how to avoid Israeli AI intelligence, how to avoid Israeli military.
To understand the deficiencies, where are they?
To understand what's the main power with them and how they can inflict damage on the Israelis. So they have they had 21 months to learn how the Israeli acts. On the other hand, if you see what the Israelis are saying, they haven't been able to understand till now how the Palestinians are fighting. So we have a small resistance group that's understanding how the Israeli is fighting and learning how to increase the pain on them. And on the other hand, we have one of the best armies in the world not able to understand till today how the resistance works inside of Gaza.
So if they maintained all these strengths that you've been highlighting, does that mean that we will witness an escalation now, as long as they're seen as successful and maintained immunity, let me say?
I think this depends on how much resources they have inside of Gaza. What's sure for now is that they have the manpower, and this is enough to make the Israelis pay the price, and this is enough to let Hamas be able to veto a ceasefire agreement. I think this is the most important thing today, is that Hamas is still able to refuse the conditions that they don't want in the ceasefire agreement.
Because they're making a difference on the ground.
Exactly.
Okay. Hamas is still strong, and it's regaining its strength both militarily and in numbers. This was acknowledged by Israeli military sources before the Knesset, indicating that the occupation forces failed to destroy the tunnels, which currently accommodate many resistance fighters. We actually spoke about these escalation and intensifying resistance operations. However, Dr. Mohammed, why hasn't Israel been able to wipe out Hamas after 21 months of war?
First of all, because Hamas is a resistance group, as long as there's one Palestinian alive inside of Gaza, he will resist the occupation. So, and that's what the Americans were saying for the Israelis. Don't go and put a very unachievable goal like destroying Hamas, because it's
a resistance group. They have the most sophisticated weapons on Earth, and the logistics and the international support, the European support, the American support, all kind of missiles that they could dream of, all technology that they want.
Let's not forget.
Why is that possible? Why is not allowing them?
Let's not forget that the U.S., the American Empire, during its high level of leading the world, have been stuck in Afghanistan for 20 years. So it's not about what you have of missiles or intelligence or weapons. It's about the fighter on the ground. When the fighter on the ground is a resistance that believes that he has to continue fighting until death, then you will have what's happening today in Gaza. Do you know the most important thing when I was hearing, I was hearing the Israeli media is that I always believe in the effect of perception, because what you perceive is how you act or react. If we see Israeli media today, many in Israel don't believe that Israel had been able to achieve something. In their perception, Israel failed. So when everything ends, it will end at the war will stop at the end of the road. When this war stops, Israel won't be able to have a victory narrative for almost 2 years inside of Gaza.
But Netanyahu's advertising for absolute victory.
Exactly.
On
this
all
comment,
fronts,
this
by
comment
the way.
And other comments tell us that Israelis perceive what's happening today as a strategic failure. Even if we read today what the Americans are saying or Israelis are saying in their media, it's always speaking about a lot of tactical achievements without one strategic achievement. And that's their problem.
A failure in achieving objectives.
Exactly.
All objectives.
Exactly.
The campaigns against Netanyahu and his ministers are intensifying within the entity due to the continued war on the Gaza Strip and the human losses suffered by the occupation army. Israeli opposition leaders have confirmed that the war continues for Netanyahu and his ministers for personal reasons. What do you think is behind this vocal campaign against Netanyahu, and what are the personal gains that they're speaking about that he wants to achieve?
No, the personal gains mainly are maintaining power, being still being the prime minister of Israel, because at different phases, his staying in this place was being threatened. He knows that as long as the war continues, then he will be able to have the votes of the far right. He will be able to have the Israelis around him, because Israel is now at war. So the main interest is him gripping on power, staying in the prime minister's chair.
Yes.
And I think what's there, first of all, we have to understand something. There are many reasons that the war is still continuing. One of them is definitely Benjamin Netanyahu's drive to stay in power. And they are expressing this. Of course,
yes.
Of course, part of their expressing is regarding Israel's internal.
And to confirm that what you're actually analyzing, Dr. Mohammed, the New York Times a couple of days ago released an article stating that Netanyahu is trying to actually prolong this war for his own personal personal stance. And this is like the first time that we see New York Times clearly and vividly explaining these kind of factors, especially when it comes to Israel and a close ally.
Yes, but look how I view American media. American media, especially New York Times and the Washington Post and the main American media outlets, they are all driven by political goals. So when an American media states such thing, it means this has been the truth for a long while, but now it's the political moment.
They decided to release it.
It's the political moment to release such news. Because
so what's the political moment?
Because some in the U.S. need to pressure Netanyahu to accept the ceasefire agreement today offered on table. So this is part of the pressure of some political groups on Netanyahu. That's how they work. But for the news to be able to get out today, this means this has been the truth for a long while.
They
now is the political moment. So yes, Netanyahu's personal gains are one of the reasons. And I can't even imagine that tens of thousands of people in Gaza have been killing. One of the reasons for that is Benjamin Netanyahu's political interests. And the whole world knows it, and no one is moving.
So despite the fact that these kind of criticism is actually intensifying in the West more than any other time, Dr. Mohammed.
Yes.
Now, moving to Syria, where direct talks are taking place between Israeli officials and officials in the Julani government on normalization. One of these close to the Syrian president expressed to the Hebrew media the Julani's government's desire to seize the rare opportunity that now presents itself for peace in the region with the Israeli occupation entity.
Said that every 100 years there's always a unique opportunity that comes probably once in a century, and there is this opportunity for peace in the Middle East right now, but we need to take advantage of it. And my understanding is that Syria wants to take advantage of it. We don't want our country to be a launching pad for wars against or attacks or terrorists against anyone, including Israel, looking for is the stop of the military incursion, respect the sovereignty of Syria, stop interfering in internal affairs, and try to resolve these issues through dialogue. Syrians, in a way, were very happy that Israel took out the leadership of Hezbollah and most of their capabilities, so Syrians could topple the Assad regime. For Syrians, Iran is it was the number one enemy. So for us, the weakening of Iran is a pleasant thing to see.
Do you think that Syria would actually join the Abraham Accords?
I'm definitely sure they will join the Abraham Accords. They are expressing it. They want it. They need it. They feel they need it, sorry. But I have some comments on what he was saying.
Yes.
Because we always hear the word peace. Everyone links the Abraham Accords and the deals with Israel with peace. Today, we have to redefine peace. What the resistance is doing is searching for peace. When when Bashar al-Assad was, when he left Syria, this wasn't a reason for Israel to attack. This wasn't a reason for peace to not be found. But Israel chose the moment. Even when Ahmed al-Shara and different Syrian political leaders were saying, we want peace with you, we want to go to an agreement with you, we won't attack you. It's the first time in history that one country is saying to the other country that we want peace, we don't want to attack you, we are friends, we want to do whatever you want, take the Golan Heights, take whatever you want. Still, Israel insisted on destroying all the capabilities of the military army, killing Syrians and destroying
and
damaging.
But these voices are on the rise. However, here a major question is supposed to be asked. So what do you think of these very frank, hostile remarks against Iran and Hezbollah from al-Julani's side, from Syrian side?
Yes. You know, I have...
An accommodation or when they're asking for peace with Israel?
I have a belief that many in the region treat Iran and its allies, number one, and Israel as a bridge. How is that? When the countries of the region need to flatter the U.S. and get it to convince
closer.
It about something, then they will go and attack Iran and Hezbollah, and they will flatter Israel. So these countries treat Hezbollah.
It's only
Iran,
for politics, it's not real hatred.
No, I really don't.
Or awkward plans being prepared.
No, there are two factions. Most of the people speaking today are out of interest, because if the same people, if they were doing 2 or 3 years back, they will have spoken differently. It depends on the political moment, the political interest, but. There are also some that have a strong belief that about Hezbollah, especially religious beliefs regarding Sunnis, Shias, and everything.
Yes.
And this is a reflection of what the Americans have been doing in the region in the last 2 decades. So we have two groups. One that capture the political moment and just... I think that Ahmed Sharaa is one of the guys that has the first group. I think he doesn't have an ideological problem with Iran or Hezbollah, but on the other side...
But Israel can fuel that, can play on that aspect.
Yeah, of course.
It's
but
a possibility.
Yes, but he is a guy that moves left and right based on his political interests and political moment. That's why he sold the Palestinian case. He sold everything he believed for just to be a president today. And we have to see what he is willing to sell.
In order to maintain power, maybe he wants to please the Americans and the Israelis.
What he will sell later on.
Israeli social media actually interacted with the ongoing normalization talks with Syria, where commentators made the case that reaching an agreement with Syria without a Palestinian state is a victory for the Israeli entity.
Yaniv, if we can integrate Syria without conditions imposed on us, that means we've won. Eitan, normalization with Syria and Saudi Arabia must be on our terms, of course, and without a Palestinian state. Privacy account. Syria is fragmented and allied with Turkey, which gives it borders with Israel. Our normalization with Damascus will help us cooperate with it to confront any potential Turkish attack on us.
Dr. Mohammed Sweden, academic and writer of international affairs, thank you very much for joining us
thank
in this
you.
Episode.
Destroying everything, everything that's dear to me. I can never be like you. You are the wicked of this world. You are the reason why we feel fear in our daily lives.
It's not about killing, it's about life and sharing. Laugh with someone. Yes, faith is not about killing, it's about life and sharing. Life and making a difference. Yeah, making a difference.
Don't involve. Lost in your own ignorance. Believe.
behind the scenes of major political changes across different parts of the world, large-scale and lucrative economic plans are often designed by prominent theorists or individuals working in the shadows. These plans operate in a way that aligns colonial superpowers to sacrifice weaker nations and plunder their natural resources. This is part of the speech by Benjamin Netanyahu, the Prime Minister of Israel, at the United Nations. It promises a grand and ambitious vision for the construction of a strategic corridor stretching from New Delhi to West Asia, a corridor that passes through the Israeli-occupied territories and reaches Europe. According to Netanyahu, this plan is to transform the lives of over 2 billion people.
This is the map I presented here last year. It's a map of a blessing. It shows Israel and its Arab partners forming a land bridge connecting Asia and Europe between the Indian Ocean and the Mediterranean Sea. Across this bridge, we will lay rail lines, energy pipelines, fiber optic cables, and this will serve the betterment of 2 billion people.
To implement and exploit this plan, major changes in the geopolitics of West Asia were underway, changes which were initiated by a devastating and destructive war and the displacement of millions in Palestine and Lebanon. Perhaps the answer to the question that many ask about why Israel is unwilling to end this war lies hidden within the secrets of grand economic schemes in cooperation with the world's superpowers. Transforming the lives of 2 billion people in other parts of the world at the cost of death, displacement, and the destruction of the homes of millions in the Middle East. The idea of connecting the Red Sea to the Mediterranean and ending Egypt's monopoly over maritime passage to the Suez Canal dates back to 1956 and the Suez Crisis. The proposed plan involves a route stretching 260 kilometers, ultimately connecting the Gulf of Aqaba and the port of Eilat to the Mediterranean by crossing the Negev Desert.
Prime Minister Ben-Gurion of Israel arrives at Princeton, New Jersey to call on Dr. Albert Einstein, one of the world's greatest scientists, the father of relativity and the man whose physics formula led the way to the atomic explosion, plays host to the leader who played a great part in the creation of the Israeli nation.
In a document recently declassified by the United States, dated 1963, Howard David Maccabee, an American specialist, proposed the idea of carrying out 520 nuclear explosions for deep excavation in the Negev Desert. This massive project became known as the Ben-Gurion Canal. In recent years, there have been rumors about the potential revival of this project. Based on the proposal, an estimated $100 billion will be required for the project's implementation, with an anticipated annual revenue of $10 billion from vessel transit fees.
The Ben-Gurion Canal was a wild proposal made in the 1960s to build a canal through Israel from the port of Eilat on the Red Sea all the way to the Mediterranean. The idea being to create an alternative route to Egypt's Suez Canal, which already connects them.
The general design of the Ben-Gurion Canal, from a technical perspective, is envisioned as a passage with a depth and width of 50 to 200 meters and rocky walls. This design has greater depth compared to the Suez Canal and requires less maintenance and repairs. Unlike the Suez Canal, this canal is planned to operate as a two-way passage for both directions. Incidents such as several cases of ships getting stuck and the blockage of the Suez Canal have once again brought up the issue of constructing and operationalizing the Ben-Gurion Canal. If the Zionist leaders succeed in implementing and operationalizing the Ben-Gurion Canal plan, many Arab and Islamic countries in the region will become directly dependent on this project. The potential commercial benefits of this plan will gradually place these countries in a difficult and limited position in future political discussions and negotiations regarding regional developments. Some political observers have linked Israel's efforts to make the Gaza Strip unlivable and to evacuate it with removing any obstacles or resistance to the implementation and exploitation of this plan.
But what is the Ben-Gurion Canal? Well, it aims to connect the Red Sea with the Mediterranean Sea. The Gaza Strip gets in the way of all of this. If you look at the mapping, the proposed direction of the Ben-Gurion Canal from the Red Sea, from Eilat, it's kind of swerving away from the Gaza Strip. But it would be very convenient if Israel controlled the Gaza Strip and had the Ben-Gurion Canal flow through there.
Moreover, routing the canal through or even near the Gaza Strip would shorten the connection between the Red Sea and the Mediterranean, reducing the overall cost of the project. In fact, the initial plan for the canal involved passing it through the port of Ashkelon, located north of Gaza. However, with implementation of a complex security plan involving the complete destruction of existing structures in the Gaza Strip and turning it into an uninhabitable area by Israel, the starting point of the canal has been selected near the northern part of Gaza. Oceanic trade in general and the remarkable economic growth of East and South Asian countries have garnered increased attention in Israeli circles. Considering the cordial relations between Israel and India, which have evolved into deep economic and commercial partnership since the 1990s, the idea of the India-Middle East-Europe corridor, whose memorandum of understanding was signed during the G20 summit in 2023, has attracted Israel's interest. Such a project could significantly impact China's mega-initiative known as the One Belt, One Road, and its efforts to establish economic influence in West Asia. Strengthening the economy of the Persian Gulf Arab countries bloc and reducing the roles of Turkey and Iran in the regional economy is considered a favorable scenario from Israel's perspective. The potential establishment of the aforementioned corridor also aligns with diminishing the significance of the North-South corridor for these two countries. In November of 2020, rumors surfaced in the media about a secret and unannounced meeting between Netanyahu, Mohammed bin Salman, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, and Mike Pompeo, the then U.S. Secretary of State, at the site of NOAM project under construction in northwest Saudi Arabia on the coast of the Red Sea.
Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu refused to discuss details of a landmark meeting with the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia that reportedly took place over the weekend.
Well, I think there is a high likelihood there was a meeting. Certainly, it could be something that happened. The American ambassador, Abizad, was with the foreign minister, and Pompeo was there, maybe in another room. MBS, the Crown Prince, met with Bibi, with Pompeo. So, you know, I think it's just a dance. But this is all the going thought is this is a message.
4 years later, amid the Gaza war, during a Likud party gathering, a proposal was raised for establishing a Gaza al-Arish Deir al-Balah free trade zone, which strengthened speculations about linking this route to the NEOM project and creating a commercial hub at the intersection of the Red Sea and the Mediterranean. Considering the proposal of the Ben-Gurion Canal, the idea of connecting these two projects and placing the Gaza Strip at their junction can also be envisioned. This could serve as an incentive for Arab countries such as Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates to invest in the reconstruction and administration of Gaza in the manner desired by Israel once the conflicts subside. On the other hand, extending this plan to Al-Arish port in Egypt and the Sinai Desert could partially alleviate Egypt's concerns about the diminishing role of the Suez Canal in global trade. Given the relative insecurity in the Sinai Desert and Gaza, which has impacted Egypt's national security, this project could create an additional attraction for Egypt's allies.
It's their 2035 Gaza plan to rebuild Gaza into an Israeli version of Dubai. Well, look no further than the brand new Gaza 2035 plan, which Netanyahu unveiled this weekend. Great timing, too. He's like, hey, we're about to destroy Rafah, totally eliminate about a million people. Here's a 9-page PDF for our plan. This is what we plan to do in Gaza, which is perfect. It's like a, you know, we want to build our own Dubai in Gaza. Perfect timing. So take a look at this. This is the new Israel 2035 plan for Gaza. Look how beautiful that will look once they rebuild it and kick all of those all those dirty Palestinians out of there. Mm-hmm. And they'll build new rail infrastructure, new port infrastructure. It'll be easy access to all of that oil, and they'll be able to get all of this into the Middle East economy. So a place so devoid of Palestinians, of course, as they describe it. They describe it as a future where Gaza is de-radicalized from Islamism, transformed into a trade hub of prosperity and innovation, and integrated into the Middle East economy. So a place totally devoid of Palestinians, of course. According to the Jerusalem Post, it's almost like they had this planned for a while, right? I mean, seems like they probably already had this whole thing mapped out a long time ago.
Beyond the issue of building a major corridor for the transportation of goods and energy, Israel is also seeking, in its midterm vision, to achieve secure and local energy resources. Israel's reliance on fossil fuels, reflected in the annual import of billions of dollars worth of oil from countries such as Azerbaijan, Brazil, Kazakhstan, and Nigeria, has led its government to make serious efforts toward attaining new and affordable energy sources.
This is the northernmost point of Israel's coast, its Mediterranean coast, but then a stone's throw away, you have that Hezbollah presence. What a contrast.
The story here is the big, huge gas, natural gas reservoir in the eastern basin of the Mediterranean. As you probably know, there has been huge discovering of amount of gas offshore Israel.
Yeah.
One of the sections, called Field Number 9, is a controversial area between Israel and Lebanon, where both sides claim to have larger parts of the specific field.
The vast gas reserves along the east Mediterranean coast, a significant portion of which are located in Lebanese waters and near the shores of occupied Palestinian territories, are an attractive option for Israel. In fact, for years now, Tel Aviv has been pursuing efforts to explore and extract gas reservoirs in the waters off the eastern Mediterranean.
Their shared maritime border in the eastern Mediterranean, it's a contested area where Israel has already found hydrocarbons that can be exploited commercially, and where Lebanon is hoping to explore for natural gas.
After the discovery of the Tamar gas field in 2009, the issue of the dispute between Israel and Lebanon regarding the delineation of ownership boundaries and adjacent waters also was raised. The judgment on this matter was entrusted to UN experts to resolve the conflict.
I would like to clarify that the Karish gas field is not disputed, and it has never been. It wasn't even within the line that Lebanon submitted to the UN, which Israel did not agree to. It is not negotiable in any way. It is an Israeli gas field, an Israeli strategic asset. It's a shame. This is not constructive. I suggest that the Lebanese negotiation team proceeds with the talks. After all, it is a civilian economic issue. They should understand that and take better care of their civilians. The state of Israel has been systematically protecting its assets. The Israeli security forces are prepared for any scenario.
Israeli officials have long coveted the Lebanese section of this gas field, which is known as the Qana'a and Karish fields.
the first look at Israel's new off-sea gas platform. The Karish gas field is being hailed as a revolutionary development for Israel's energy production sector, and plans exist to export its gas to help ease the global energy crisis. But the site has also become a target for cross-border threats from within Israel's northern neighbor.
The efforts to incite war and weaken Hezbollah's defensive capabilities, along with the Lebanese army's strong dependency on Western countries, are also aimed at ensuring the security of the new platforms that are planned to be built in the Karish gas field in the future.
Only recently, Israel imported its energy from around the world. For the energy minister, the course is clear. Thanks to gas, the country will not only soon be energy independent, but a net gas exporter.
Currently, with the discovery of the Gaza Marine ore and NOAA oil in gas fields and waters near Gaza, the importance of security in this region has increased for Israel.
There are two gas fields under the Gaza Strip. Gaza Marine 1 and Gaza Marine 2. They were found in 1999, nearly 25 years ago. In 2000, the Palestinian Authority, that was one of the organizations that participated in this secret meeting in Geneva, they requested British Gas explore what they thought was under the Gaza Strip. And British Gas identified a 30 billion cubic meter of gas reserves under the Gaza Strip.
Initial searches for oil and gas resources in the waters near the Gaza Strip were conducted in the late 1990s by the British company BBG, leading to the discovery of the large Gaza Marine gas field located 17 to 21 nautical miles off the Gaza coast. According to the second Oslo Accord, signed in 1995, ownership of the Gaza Marine gas field was granted to the Palestinian Authority.
The problem is that Israel has not signed any related convention so far, including, and this is the most important, the Convention of the Law of the Sea. Israel is out of the international community's rules.
In 2000, a 25-year contract was signed between the Palestinian Authority and the BBG company, which led to the development of exploration activities. It was estimated the Gaza Marine gas field contained over 1.4 trillion cubic feet of extractable natural gas, which could have served as a solid economic foundation for the Palestinian Authority.
This is just one of the many reserves of fossil fuels that are in Israel, in the occupied territory of Palestine, and in international waters. Now, in 2019, the UN released a report on these fuels, stating that they were valued at $524 billion. Now, that's half a trillion in 2019 money. Under no circumstances would a Netanyahu government allow for Palestine to exploit.
Israel's illegal occupying actions regarding energy resources and waters near Gaza reflect the long-term ambitions of this regime to access the energy resources of the Mediterranean and Gaza. These actions are carried out with the aim of imposing its policies and objectives on Palestine and Lebanon through the use of force and military power.
But if it's gas and oil, and they have a canal that's making them, could be, tens of billions of dollars profit per year, 50 billion barrels of oil under the Gaza Strip. And the strategy for the Israelis, they've said this.
One of the main reasons for the recent war and the forced displacement of Gaza Strip residents to a small area in the southern part of this region is Israel's fixation on Gaza's vast gas reserves. Following complete occupation and removal of any obstacles and resistance in this area, Israel aims to securely seize all the fossil reserves along the Gaza coast for its own benefit.
comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the lantern.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim, in the name of Allah. Salam and welcome. You are listening to Lantern, a new story, and many moral issues about this story. And today's story entitled, Detaching Yourself? Yes, detaching myself. And this is important, not just for someone like me who is dying, but for someone like you who is perfectly healthy. Learn to detach. He opened his eyes. He exhaled. Don't cling to things, because everything is impermanent. But wait, I said, aren't you always talking about experiencing life? All the good emotions, all the bad ones. Yes, well, how can you do that if you're detached? You're thinking, Mitch. But detachment doesn't mean you don't let the experience penetrate you. On the contrary, you let it penetrate you fully. That's how you're able to live it. I'm lost. Take any emotion, love for a woman, or grief for a loved one, or what I'm going through, fear and pain from a deadly illness. If you hold back on the emotions, if you don't allow yourself to go all the way through them, you can never get to being detached. You're too busy being afraid. You're afraid of the pain. You're afraid of the grief. You're afraid of the vulnerability that loving entails. But by throwing yourself into these emotions, by allowing yourself to dive in all the way, over your head even, you experience them fully and completely. You know what pain is. You know what love is. You know what grief is. And only then can you say, all right, I have experienced that emotion. I recognize that emotion. Now I need to detach from that emotion for a moment. Maury stopped and looked me over, perhaps to make sure I was getting this right. I know you think this is just about dying, he said. But it's like I keep telling you, when you learn how to die, you learn how to live.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh. Dear audience, welcome to a new episode of Lantern from IRIB English Radio. This is Zainab Musavi, and in this program, what we do is to listen to certain religious stories and then try to take out some of the important themes and lessons that we can make use of them in our daily lives as Muslims. Well, today we want to talk about the philosophy of difficulties and the sorrows in life and the way they affect our worldwide and ideology towards life. You know, life is full of challenges and difficulties. It consists of different events that result in various feelings and emotions. Marriage, divorce, birth, death, success, failure, wealth, poverty, health and sickness. Every human, without exception, experiences some of these kind of challenges. No one in this world is absolutely problem-free. It is just the nature of life. Some people may not have financial problems, but they may have family problems. Others might have financial struggles, but have strong families and good health. The Holy Book of Quran says, أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم لَقَدْ خَلَقْنَا الْإِنسَانَ فِي كَبَدْ We have created man into constant toil. Surah Al-Balad, verse number 4. So how are we to understand and deal with these challenges? And Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says in his holy book, أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم فَأَمَّا الْإِنسَانُ إِذَا مَبْتَلَاهُ رَبُّهُ فَأَكْرَمَهُ وَنَعَامَهُ فَيَقُولُ رَبِّي أَكْرَمًا وَأَمَّا إِذَا مَبْتَلَاهُ فَقَدَرَ عَلَيْهِ رِزْقُهُ فَقَدَرَ عَلَيْهِ رِزْقَهُ فَيَقُولُ رَبِّي أَهَانًا كَلَّا بَلَّا تُكْرِمُونَ الْيَتِيمَ. As for man, when his Lord tries him by giving him honor and blessings, then he says, puffed off, my Lord has honored me. But when he tries him and restricts his provision, he says, my Lord has humiliated me. No, but you indeed do not honor the orphan. Surah Al-Fajr, verses number 15 to 17. So as you see in this verse, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala sends difficulties not only in cases when he wants to punish his servants, but also when he loves one of his servants. He tests the servant with different types of tests and hardships. Hence, we can conclude that having and not having is not a sign of God's love. One may have a life full of challenges, poverty, and sickness. However, it is ultimately God's pleasure that is most important and the source of true happiness and peace. The Prophet ﷺ said, amazing is the affair of the believer. Verily, all of his affairs are good, and this is not for no one except for the believer. If something of good or happiness befalls him, he is grateful, and that is good for him. If something of harm befalls him, he is patient, and that is good for him. Okay, let's go for a short break, and we will be back in no time.
The Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
Welcome back to your audience. You are listening to Lantern, and we are talking about the concept of difficulties in our religion. Well, viewing difficulties as a source of love of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala changes the believer's outlook on life. Something might be harmful, but he views it as a temporary difficulty and transforms it into an eternal blessing. By being patient, when is he or she afflicted with something, they know that this affliction is actually good in the end. You may dislike something although it is good for you, or like something although it is bad for you. God knows and you don't know. And finally, everyone is challenged in life at some level. We are all equal in that regard, and no one can escape both having and not having in some respects. Where we differ is in our attitude and perception of these events. The Holy Book of Quran reshapes the human mind to not view wealth, fame, and materialistic luxury as sources of happiness and God's pleasure. Rather, they can, in fact, lead to misery and sadness. Happiness is found in the attitude of being pleased with God's decree and being near to Him. And finally, I want to end this episode with this elegant hadith from Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam, which says, you are not believers unless you are trusted by the people. Count calamities as blessings and consider easy life as a calamity, since perseverance in the face of a calamity is better than well-being while having an easy life. So we should keep strong in case of any hardship and thank God for it, and in that way win His pleasure and attention. Okay, dear listeners, thank you very much for listening to this episode of Lantern. And until another one, I bid you farewell and may Allah protect you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was all for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Inshallah, we continue this topic on the next episode. Till then, may Allah bless all of you. Fi amanillah. Greetings from the capital, Tehran. You're listening to Iran Radio, and today's program are built to enrich the soul and awaken the mind. So lean in, listen closely, and let the stories speak to you. For this hour, our focus turns to round the world with reporters. Then it's time for profound guidance with leaders' speech. After that, we'll have spotlight. Stay tuned for round the world with reporters.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Iruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
A small village near Ramallah, 13 years old Amar Hamayel was more than a child. He was a rising star in Muay Thai, also known as Thai boxing. With a heart full of passion and fists trained for glory, Amar dreamed of raising Palestine's flag on the international podiums. But Israeli bullets shattered that dream, ending his life and leaving behind silence where cheers once echoed.
Ammar left the house around noon to buy juice. He promised he would be back quickly for lunch. But minutes later, Israeli force opened fire. A bullet hit him in the back. The Israeli intelligence called us and said, "Your son is with us, lightly injured, but he was dying."
As villagers rushed to rescue Ammar, the Israeli soldiers held them back. It took over an hour for an ambulance to reach him. By then, the damage was done. Ammar died on the way to the hospital.
Everyone in the town tried to reach him, but we were blocked. The ambulance was delayed. The roads were closed. He died in the ambulance. My child, my little man, I still can't believe he's gone.
Ammar was the youngest member of his Muay Thai team. Having started at the age of 9, he traveled, trained, and won medals, his eyes always fixed on the future.
Maybe it's forbidden for our children to dream. There is always occupation standing in their way. Ammar, my child, was one of them. They murdered his childhood, just like they do with so many others.
Ammar's teammates share their feelings too about his martyrdom.
Ammar was like a brother to me. When he was martyred, it broke my heart. Life with him was full of laughter. He was like a flower, always dreaming of raising Palestine's name high.
Ammar's gloves now rest quietly in a drawer. His medals hang without pride. His dreams were not too big, but the walls, guns, and soldiers that surrounded him were.
Ammar Hamayel was not just a boy. He was a future, a fighter, and a dream. And though his last match was stolen, his story will not be forgotten. Naqa Hamid, Kufr Malik, Occupied West Bank.
Memorial ceremony in Tehran to honor the martyred IRGC commander, Lieutenant General Mohammad Said Izadi, a national hero who lost his life in the recent Israeli aggression against Iran. The ceremony, filled with a sense of gratitude and deep admiration, serving as a poignant occasion to remember the sacrifices he made in the fight against the Israeli regime and in strengthening the resistance front.
His name shines brightly among those who fought against the Zionist regime. His cause and ideals remain vibrant, and his blood continues to strengthen his path more than ever.
He was a remarkably strong individual, unwavering in his commitment to the ideals of the Islamic Revolution. For many years, he dedicated himself to serving the Palestinian people, and his legacy continues to endure.
Throughout his service as an IRGC commander, he collaborated closely with all the prominent figures of the resistance front. This remarkable leader worked relentlessly to gather vital knowledge and technology, fortifying the resistance movement and establishing an enduring impact in the battle against adversaries.
Lieutenant General Izadi's tireless efforts in securing the necessary expertise, technology, and resources have strengthened the resistance front, leaving a lasting legacy in the fight against the enemy. Fires on Ashur, Tehran.
A 2024 report by the Palestinian Central Bureau of Statistics indicates that over 60% of West Bank farmers face difficulties in marketing their products due to checkpoints and